This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Utterly Moderate is the official podcast of the Connors Institute for Nonpartisan Research and Civic Engagement at Shippensburg University. Please visit us at connorsinstitute.org to sign up for our free email newsletter. While you are there, also be sure to check out all of our great research and resources.
Please listen carefully. Carefully.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the program. This is the Utterly Moderate Podcast, and I'm your host, Lawrence Eppard. Thank you so much for joining us. It seems like there's a billion podcasts out there, and I know you can have your pick of the litter, and I appreciate the fact that you chose this one today, so thank you so much. On today's program, we're going to try to tackle a really big question, and we're not going to completely answer the question, but we'll try to get a better understanding by the time we're done with this conversation. And that question is, when you're making big decisions in your life, especially, you know, really important decisions like medical decisions, how do you know what the best evidence says? It's actually a much thornier question than you might think, because all of us can point to one research study that agrees with pretty much anything we believe, but that's not assessing the evidence, right? So yeah, there's lots of studies out there that say lots of different things. But you should really be looking at the strongest studies and what the trend is among those studies. So the question is, how do you do that? That's really hard for the average citizen to do. It can even be difficult for medical professionals to do. So to help us understand this question and try to answer it at least a little bit, we're joined today by Dr. Sally Baxendale. She's a professor of clinical neuropsychology at the Institute of Neurology at University College London. Dr. Baxendale, I am very privileged to have you on the program today. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you for asking me.
So I happen to know something that I learned in our communications leading up to this interview. You happen to turn down another program to tape this one with me today. And what program was that, Dr. Baxendale?
Well, so I received an email this morning from Fox and Friends asking me to talk about the ban on puberty blockers that the NHS, the British Health Service, has just introduced yesterday. But I'd already committed myself to you, so here I am.
Thank you, Dr. Baxendale. And this is an audio program, so you guys can't see the regret on her face that she committed to me first. But
there's no regret.
Well, thank you so much. I really do appreciate it. Okay, so today we're going to talk about how people assess evidence. And it actually, I think, you know, when I talk to some people about this, you know, some just sort of average citizens about this, I think it often comes across as an easier question to answer than it actually is. Because even people who should know a lot better than me, like medical professionals, can oftentimes fail and have a difficult time in assessing evidence. So I think you've written a lot of great stuff and you've done a lot of really important research and you've spent your career focusing on these kinds of things. And so I guess I'll just ask you, for medical professionals, and you've been looking at gender medicine in particular lately, for medical professionals, how do they assess? Because there's lots of studies that say lots of different things, right?
How
do they assess what the best evidence says?
Yeah. I mean, I think quite often you'll see people saying things like, well, you can always find a study to back up what you want to believe or what you want to think or to back up your practice. And to some extent, that's true. So you can go into the literature and find all sorts of little studies, small studies, not very well conducted studies that may tell you one thing or another. But really in medicine, what we're looking at is a kind of, it's called the pyramid of evidence. So right at the very bottom of the pyramid, there's evidence that comes from kind of consensus. And if you go and do a survey of doctors and say, you know, well, what do you think the best treatment for a headache is? You can get them and they will say kind of what the best treatment is. And that's one level of evidence. It's expert consensus. And then you can go through randomized controlled trials, which will test out, you know, randomize people and give them one treatment and compare it to either a placebo or another type of treatment. And that will give you a little bit more evidence that you can have a little bit more faith in the results. And then right at the top of that evidence tree is really the meta-analyses. So these are the studies that look at all of the studies that have investigated particular treatments and really weighed up the evidence. And they will tell you, is there strong evidence for a particular treatment or not? So it's really the studies of the studies that tell us what we know. And quite often when you do those studies, things that we think we know as doctors, actually there's not that much evidence for it. And that's the same in that, certainly that's the case in a lot of gender medicine, but that's the same across a lot of areas of medicine. And actually a lot of areas of psychological interventions as well, you don't always find the best levels of evidence for it, but it's the best that we've got. So it's kind of what people go to. So I think somebody contacted me recently and said that when they were training, their medical trainer said to them, 60% of what you learn at medical school will have changed by the time that you finish medical school, because we're in a constant state of flux in terms of what we know. And the 40% that won't change is probably anatomy, because that's kind of more or less settled, more or less. So with medicine, we go with what we are familiar with, and we're constantly updating our knowledge as we realise that different systems are connected and different, particularly more recently, we're more interested in how the environment affects people's health and things like that. So we're in a constant state of flux. There is no or very little settled science when it comes to medicine.
So Dr. Baxendale, I have to ask you, what led you to this interest in how we assess evidence?
Yeah, I mean, I think my work, I mean, it fits in with my work. So for the last 30 years, I've really worked on outcomes and evidence-based practice. That's my kind of passion. And the reason for that is because I come from where the space that I work in medicine has a very dark history. So, you know, I work on an epilepsy surgery program, which really emerged from the kind of psychosurgery of the 40s and 50s. So we came from a very dark place in medicine, and lots of people were harmed in the journey that we've got to now, where we do actually provide, you know, good evidence-based care to people. And part of that harm came because people were not assessing outcomes properly. So they were not using an evidence base. They were assuming things. They weren't following people up. So when you work in that tradition, always at the forefront of my mind is the balance between helping people and making sure that the harm that most medical interventions, you know, are doing something that may be harmful, but it's always a risk benefit analysis. So that's kind of my life's work, really, is making sure that all of the interventions that we offer, particularly if they're elective and they're not kind of, you know, life saving, somebody on the table, you've got to do something immediately. If you've got time to think about it, time to really consider the risk benefit ratios of what you're offering, making sure that that's right for people. So it's not completely out of the kind of what I've done up to date to start looking at this. And one of the things that I do every year, I teach epilepsy and I teach epilepsy surgery and the history of that. And I always finish my lectures with, there are things we are doing now that the future generations will look back on and say, why were they doing that? How could they be doing that? And so when I came across this claim that puberty blockers were completely safe and reversible, it really started to ring alarm bells because when I started to look at the evidence for that, it was like, I think this might be that. I think this might be one of those areas where they look back on and think, what were they doing? Because when you start to look into the evidence for safe and completely reversible, it's just not there. And an absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, unfortunately. And I think that's what's happened along the way.
You have to apologize for my Americanization of this word, but I'll say meta-analysis. So let's talk very briefly about that, and then we'll dive into some other topics. But when you're doing these studies of studies, mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because it's not just, they're not just taking an average of what do all these studies say. They're taking into account effect sizes and the strength of methodology and all those sorts of things. So can you talk a little bit about what that looks like, what a meta-analysis is?
Yeah, so there are really strict rules about how to conduct these kind of studies of studies. So the way that they are, the rules are quite strict. It means that anybody who was looking at this would be able to reproduce it and come up with the same conclusions. So you have to have very strict rules about how you find the studies that fulfill your criteria. Once you've found those studies, you will then be grading them. You normally would have two or three people grading them independently so that you can make sure that nobody's individual bias is coming in. And you also assess those studies themselves for bias. So you'll be looking at how many people were in the studies. You'll be looking at how the studies were funded, possibly. There are all sorts of ways of assessing that. So it's not just adding up all the positive findings and saying there are lots of studies that say this. You really look at where those studies came from, how well they were conducted, how well they were controlled, and then they kind of get scored and they would get a higher weighting. So a randomized control trial, for example, will get a higher rating than a single case study that just found that some change in somebody that wasn't very well controlled. So that they really are the gold standard at the moment of what we have, just as a measure of our current knowledge. That's what these studies tell us.
Okay, can you talk a little bit about, you know, one of the things they look at in these meta-analyses, is effect sizes. And I try to explain this in my classes. I talk about correlations are one thing, right? But they really only kind of show how well these data points cluster together. They're not showing you how much something increases or decreases over time. That's an effect size, right? So can you talk a little bit about that? We'll get to the difference between, say, like, you know, correlational or multivariate analyses versus clinical trials in a moment. But can you talk a little bit about effect sizes and how that would play into your assessment of research studies in a meta-analysis?
Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of effect size, sometimes you can find something that is reliable. So you can find it amongst a number of studies, but actually the impact that it has on the variable that you're looking at isn't particularly large. So you may find an effect size of something completely random, like eating an orange every day may have an impact on your iron levels because vitamin C helps you to absorb iron. So, but it might be a very small part of that bigger picture of all of the factors that influence how you absorb iron. So the effect size is important. So it will tell you if there is something that you should be looking at, but it will also tell you how important it is. So sometimes if you don't have a big effect size, it's not something that maybe is that important, and you may have missed the bigger picture and the bigger variable that might be influencing something. So it is quite important to look at effect sizes. Yeah.
Yeah. I always tell my students, I give them examples of like, you know, what if I told you that, you know, driving in a car was bad for your health, and everybody who drives in a car, you know, lives a shorter life, you'd probably be appalled. And then I said, well, people that drive cars, they live 1 minute shorter in life than everybody else who does not. And you might say to yourself, yeah, that's a trade-off I'm willing to make, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly that. And you often see that in medicine where they say, you know, there's a 50% increase in something, but it's from such a small base level. It might go from 0.001 to 0.002 or something like that. And it's so small. It's there, but it's so small. We need to really be cognizant of that when we're thinking about this.
Well, and in the really stupid example that I just gave, you could say to somebody, you could have a big blaring study, right, that comes out on one of the big media sites that says there's been 100% increase in the negative impact of cars. It'd be from 1 minute shorter life to 2 minute shorter
exactly
life, right?
That. So, exactly that.
Again, you need to understand that. And a meta-analysis would take that into account, right?
Exactly that. Yep.
And another thing that they take into account, like you said, is the strength of methodologies. And I think this is really, really important because I had a discussion one time with Garen Wintemute. We on this podcast, we were talking about gun violence and studies about gun control and those sorts of things. And he was really critical of studies that weren't clinical trials, that weren't randomized, that were just sort of correlational or multivariate, that looked for associations in big data between variables. And I think that's particularly true in medicine, that there's a big difference in quality between clinical trials and other types of studies that look for correlation. So could you talk about the importance of those methodologies?
Absolutely. So if you're looking at just a methodology that has correlated something with something, you may well have missed out a third factor that is actually influencing both of those things. And that's why it's so important to do controlled trials and ideally randomized controlled trials where you can control for those things. So you can randomize people to one group or another, give one group a treatment, another group, they don't get the treatment, and then you can actually assess that treatment. So if we're thinking about a randomized controlled trial, we are thinking about making sure controlling as many variables as we can in terms of who gets a treatment and who doesn't, and trying to make them equal groups in as many features as we can so that we can actually look at the impact of the treatment. And that means that people will be getting the same dose. We'll be assessing them at the same time frames after they've got the dose, and we'll be assessing them on the same outcomes. And that's in the group that get the medicine, and it's also in the group that don't get the medicine. So we're making sure that we control as much as possible. If we just did a survey of everybody who, for example, took aspirin for, do you have aspirin in the UK? Yeah. Who took aspirin for a headache, then you might get all sorts of things, the availability of aspirin, whether or not they were already prescribed aspirin for another condition. There'll be all sorts of other variables if you just did a survey of people who took aspirin for headache. So what we do in a clinical trial is really try and control for all of that so that we've got two matched groups, and the only thing that's different between them, or the main thing that's different between them, is the drug that we're giving them or the treatment that we're giving them. It doesn't always have to be a drug. It can be any kind of treatment.
Now, unfortunately, a lot of our conversation has really focused on how this works in a perfect world, right? If everybody does studies correctly and the peer review process operates as it should, and you know, science vets the research in the way that it should be vetted. But as you yourself have written, in many areas of research, such as things like gender-affirming care, we're finding that this process maybe isn't working as intended. People aren't doing the best research. The peer review process isn't always doing a very good job of vetting it. The scientific community isn't always doing a good job of seeing bad studies and pointing them out. And medical professionals themselves aren't always communicating the weight of the true evidence to their patients, right? So it seems incredibly complicated.
I mean, probably the best way to talk about that would be my experience with a review of the impact of puberty blockers on cognitive function that I completed recently. So when I heard that puberty blockers were said to be completely reversible and had no long-term impact, as a neuropsychologist, I was really interested in that because that kind of goes against everything we think about when we are thinking about neurodevelopment, because we know that puberty is a key window of opportunity when it comes to neurodevelopment. So there are lots of these windows of opportunity throughout childhood. So they start when we're very young. There's a kind of opportunity to, the brain is primed to start to wire up all of the language areas, and they become all wired up when we're young, and then the very first bits that are wired up are actually vision. So we come out and we start to wire up kind of how to see, and then we start motor, and then we start language. And then when we get to adolescence, the puberty is a key window of opportunity for wiring up all of the kind of executive functions. So learning nuance, learning sort of to really think about things conceptually, also all sorts of social cognition begins to really kind of develop during that that period of adolescence. So, and we know that the a lot of this is triggered by the hormones that are kind of racing through your brain when you hit puberty. So when I heard that you could just pause that, I was quite surprised, because you certainly can't pause the earlier windows of opportunity. If you don't get language input when that language window is open, you don't develop language properly. If you don't get visual input when the visual window is open, you will never, you learn to see a bit, but not, it's not properly wired up. So the idea that you could just stop puberty and somehow everything would just be wired up later on, I really wanted to see how that could be. So I came to this with a fairly, I would say, inquiring mind, because I wanted to know what the evidence was for it, because it didn't fit in with my view of how the brain worked. I didn't really have a feeling one way or the other in terms of gender, but it didn't fit in with my view of how the brain worked. So I really wanted to look at that evidence. And when I looked for it, I just couldn't find it. So nobody has really properly looked at the impact of puberty blockers on cognitive function. There are some animal studies out there that have shown that it does seem to have an impact on some aspects of animal behavior. There are a few studies that have looked at this in trans and gender diverse people. But really, there's nothing to say that it doesn't have an impact, because nobody has really looked. So I wrote a review of these papers, not many of them. I think there's about 11 in animals, and there's about 5 in people, and sent that out really just as a, we don't know much here and we really need to do a lot more research. And it was then when I started to get the reviews back that something very different was happening, was clearly happening in this branch of medicine that I haven't ever encountered in any of the papers that I've written before. So normally if you write a paper, I mean, it's certainly not the first paper that I've ever had rejected at all. Normally if you write a paper, you will get reams and reams of suggestions on how to improve it. So somebody will read through and they'll say, well, I don't think your search strategy was very good and you've missed this. Or they'll say, you know, I don't think you've really considered this aspect. And generally those comments are really helpful, because you go back and you review your search strategy and you find the extra papers and you improve the paper. So that, I'm very used to that. And I've edited journals and I do that. I also send out these comments. I review papers very, very often. So I'm very used to that process. But the comments that I got back on this paper, which was really just saying, we there's not a lot of evidence here and we need to do some more research. This is an area that we need to be looking at. They weren't methodological criticisms. They were, I think I could only describe them as ideological criticisms. So they didn't really like the findings as opposed to the methods. And I think the implications of those findings. And that's a worry in medicine, because we can't have an area where you that's kind of like a no-go area in terms of ideology, because we're looking at treatments for people. So we have to be able to say, we don't know what the outcomes here and we need to look at the outcomes. We have to be able to say that.
One of the comments you got back from reviewers, and you wrote about this in Unheard, and we'll link this in the show description. One of the comments you got back from reviewers just kind of floored me. I mean, many of the comments were bad, and we'll discuss those in a moment. But one of the comments just, I legitimately, and maybe you can answer this question for me, like, is there any value in what they said here, because I couldn't find any, which is, I thought about, if I'm a doctor, I'm not, I'm a sociologist, you know, I'm barely a PhD. But if I was a doctor and I was looking for a really good, solid, rigorous study to show me the state of the evidence, and because I wanted to convey that to my patients, right? Hey, look, here's the risk you're taking on. Here's how much we know. Here's how much we don't know. And so it's your decision, but I want you to have all the information. If the best studies were saying we really don't know, and there's not a lot of information out there, that's a really crucial thing that I need to then convey to my patients, which is, hey, you still have the right to make this decision. But I'm just telling you, we don't actually know. Like you say, there's only 15 studies. This many are in humans. This many are in animals. It's largely experimental. And there's just not a lot of good evidence. It's not only that the evidence isn't great, but there's just not a lot of it. That would be crucial for me as a patient to hear from a doctor. And one of the reviewers said, basically, your review wasn't worth doing because there wasn't enough literature. That is a crucial finding in my mind.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the more astonishing reasons for rejection that I received. And it really was exactly what you've just said. If this was my child and I was considering all of the options, I would want to know as much as possible about the benefits and also the side effects. And if we don't know about the side effects, then we need to know that we don't know about the side effects. It's not saying don't go ahead. It's saying we don't know. And I thought that this paper would be really useful for, I tried to write it in a fairly accessible way for, you know, an intelligent parent who would be thinking about the options, but also for anybody who was recommending this for their child, for their patient. Given that the impression is that we know this and people are saying that puberty blockers are safe and fully reversible, it implies that we have done the studies and we know that, and actually we don't. So it is quite an important message to get out there.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're doing, again, this is my very untrained sociological perspective on this, but if I'm doing a study about the state of the evidence, I need to deliver a verdict, whatever it is, whether it's strong, weak, non-existent. There's got to be some answer. It can't just be, well, you know, we're not going to publish it because it's not strong enough. Well, then you need to just say whatever it is that you found, right?
Absolutely. And you know, I would suggest that my conclusions in the study were very much, we don't know. And it's really important that we find out, and we need to do some more research. And this is a group that deserves the best, the evidence-based care that every other condition gets. So that was my conclusion.
And I think it's important to note, you know, I've read, and again, I haven't verified this myself, but people that I trust have written this. I've read that some of the most prestigious journals reject 90% or more of the manuscripts that they get. So rejection is not uncommon. But I think this is an important point to make, which is this is not just Dr. Baxendale expressing sour grapes. This is, you know, if this were a bad review and it never got published, then the critiques could equally be on Dr. Baxendale. She did a poor job. This was eventually published, and it was published in a good journal, right? So the study itself that you did, I don't think is the problem.
No, and yeah, I would yeah, just echo that. I'm not moaning that the study was rejected at all. And it may not have been a good fit for some of the journals. There may have been a whole number of reasons why the editors said no, and that's absolutely fine. What was really extraordinary for me was that the reviewer's comments that clearly fed into the decision, and it was that the comments were not were not something that I have ever experienced in my history of academic publishing, which is 30 years.
So a few minutes ago when you were talking about the developmental period of puberty and how important it is and how it links back to other periods of development, it struck me, I was thinking about this other comment that you got, and I wanted you to talk about it and discuss sort of how you know it's the consensus versus what this person claims. So one of the reviewers, who I can't imagine is a neuroscientist, but anyway, I mean, so here's the comment. It was, you wrote about this in Unheard. You said, another reviewer sought to diminish an entire field of neuroscience that has established puberty as a critical period of brain development as my view, meaning Sally's view. I mean, is there a lot of debate that puberty is a key period of your neurodevelopment?
No. So I think you know, there's a lot in psychology that we are unsure of, but when it comes to the development of all sorts of functions during adolescence, it's pretty clear that this is critical. So, and we know this not just from experimental psychology, but also the fMRI, the functional MRI studies that kind of almost show you how these things are being connected up almost in real time. So you can scan children kind of through their adolescence, and you can see the fibers just kind of connecting up, and the front bit of the brain connecting to the rest of the brain, and you can really kind of see it happening, and you can see it kind of being disrailed and how the whole process can get go a bit out of sync if people get head injuries and other things that can influence their function. And I think, well, I know actually that the people who work in gender were aware of this, because they started off collecting all of this data at baseline. Presumably because they were going to follow up and see what happened. But for some reason, that never happened. I don't know if I can say this, actually. But, well, so after I published my piece in Unheard, I was contacted by a lot of people, one of whom was working in imaging. And they said that they had been, because they're quite an eminent person in imaging, and they had been approached to do an imaging study in a trans population, but were told at the outset that they wouldn't be able to publish anything negative. And that was at the beginning. So they didn't actually go ahead with that study. But if you've got that going into a study, it's really going to limit what you can find out about this population. I don't know if we can put that in. It was the most distressing email, honestly.
My goodness. I have heard many, many unethical things that have been happening in all, it's not just gender medicine.
No, it's medicine. I mean, it's
psychology. Well, I mean, yeah. But psychology, it's sociology. And it's just hard not to.
I mean, that was extraordinary.
So another comment that you got was, and again, this one struck me as very odd. I've never been asked to do this in my publishing career. I've never heard somebody be asked to do this in their publishing career, but I could also be wrong. It could be happening in my own field and I just don't know about it. It could be happening in other fields and it's just not the norm in ours. And so I have to ask you, this struck me as very odd, but maybe the norms are different. So have you reflect on it, but they asked you, so you did this review, you didn't find a lot of good evidence out there that these things are fully safe and reversible. And one of the reviewers asked you, okay, we believe you. And they all agreed that you had done the study correctly and that you had exhausted all of the research that you could exhaust in published peer reviewed journals. They said, okay, so what you should do is let's get a more positive spin on this. Go through conference presentations, non-peer-reviewed conference presentations, and include those in your review. Now, non-peer-reviewed means that it could be anything. I mean, you know, nobody has checked to see if this person has done bad research, flawed research, ideological research. It hasn't, nobody, there's been no other set of eyes on it. Science is not solitary and individual. Science is social and collective. We gain knowledge because we vet our findings and people improve upon it and critique it and those sorts of things. So the idea that you would go to non-peer-reviewed conference presentations, I mean, I can get a paper into a conference with just an abstract. So you tell me, was that a weird, I mean, maybe it's a norm in your field. I don't know. It just, in my field, it just seemed very odd.
No, I've never, ever encountered that at all. I mean, no, and certainly in this kind of analysis, when you're really trying to look for the best, just to take effectively, I mean, as you say, a conference abstract is 250 words of somebody that it's not been checked. It's nothing has been done to that at all. So no, that's not any level of evidence that you would include. So I was really surprised to see that. But I was also surprised, not only did they say go and look at that, but they also said because the reasons that the positive things that are said at conferences may not have got into the literature is because nobody wants to publish that. Nobody wants to publish that there was no impact and that it's safe and reversible. And that's just not true. I mean, if there was good evidence that an intervention is safe and reversible, that's headline news. That's a good study. People would want to read that. They would want to publish that. So the idea that there's some sort of bias out there whereby that would not have been published, so it only ever got to a conference is just nonsense in my view.
All right. So one of the comments that you got was that you use sex-based terms. So natal sex, male to female, female to male, which indicated a pre-existing skepticism and that including terms like that would cause people to outright dismiss your article. And you are preaching to the choir and you're doing a poor job of attracting new members to the fold. Now, again, it seems to me like you're using terms that are perfectly normative in the medical field, number one. And number two, your job is not to attract people to any fold. Your job was to report the state of the evidence. Am I wrong on that?
No, I mean, you're absolutely right. And there are lots of ways that people describe the trans and gender diverse populations that they've studied. So one of the most frequent is male to female or female to male, and that's quite clear. So I said right at the very beginning of the review, this is how it's going to be standardized throughout so that you know. So I'm not using different terms for different papers, just so people know what you are talking about. But I think it was, again, one, I was quite surprised in a medical review to be told that using male and female would actually stop people from reading the paper, particularly people working in this field. But two, the kind of religious overtones, bringing people into the fold and preaching to the choir. I'm not attempting to convert anybody, and I wasn't attempting to change anybody's mind. I was presenting some evidence that people need to be aware of, or lack of evidence that people need to be aware of. So again, I was quite surprised to see that in a review of an academic paper.
Okay, so Dr. Baxendale, the people producing meta-analyses, you know, should be doing it a certain way, but there are, of course, some failures, and you've described some of them in your own experience. It's not clear that all fields of medicine are doing a great job of assessing the evidence and then communicating it to their patients. So if all of that is happening in the world of knowledge production and in the medical field, if we're having a hard enough time in those circles, then the average citizen who has none of this training and none of this knowledge, we're adrift. And I just want to give you one example. And, you know, I know this is an audio program, so, you know, folks listening, this may not translate very well, but I want to have Dr. Baxendale, if she's willing. You never thought you were going to come on a podcast and do something this elementary and ridiculous. But if you could bring up your Google machine for
yep.
me, Dr. Baxendale,
yep.
I want to have you experience life like an average citizen like me.
Okay.
So search for the risk of suicide for transgender youth or just transgender individuals, and or a research study, you know, include one of those keywords, and then click the news tab and just tell me, you know, what are some of the messages you get that pop up from Google?
Oh, so, well, that's interesting. So I've got two that are, so if I'm looking at the American sites that are coming to me, more than 40% of transgender adults in the US have attempted suicide. That's from the Williams Institute. The New York Times, transgender people have higher suicide risk. So there's a landmark study from Denmark. And that's a Danish CNN, significantly higher suicide risk from Denmark. Science is, yeah, so lots and lots of much higher risk of suicide, landmark study shows.
So I did this search myself before we came on the air in anticipation of this. And I went down the list like 10 deep. You know, there's going to be hundreds of returns, but I went like 10 deep and I found some that referred to the Finnish study and they said, you know, that it's not higher in trans youth. Some that refer to different studies like Denmark and others that say it is higher. I found a pretty clear split. Left-leaning publications like CNN, the New York Times were reporting the ones that said it was higher. Places that are more conservative or at least will be willing to publish conservative points of view like Unheard and other ones, said, no, it's not higher. So you're a neuropsychologist. You've got all this training. You know what the evidence is. You've done review studies yourself. But doing that now and looking through Google and seeing how most of us are getting information, if we're even taking the time to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, do you see how hard this is?
I think it's absolutely impossible. I mean, I think it's really, really hard when all of these studies are being filtered through one kind of news outlet or another. And it, I mean, if what you're, you know more about the kind of US news landscape than me, but if it's kind of like become a partisan issue where the kind of right thinks one thing and the left thinks another thing, I don't know where that leaves the actual objective truth, which is likely to be nuanced. And I have actually read the most recent study of suicide, which does say that young trans people are more likely to commit suicide, but it also says it's not due to the fact of their gender identity. It's all sorts of other factors that contribute to that. So it's a very complex, nuanced story. And when you have that complexity, if you have got a news landscape that will just pull out something that has a grain of truth in it, but just fulfills your particular narrative, all you will get is a kind of echo chamber of more and more and more of the same. And actually what we need is something that is not party political, that is not right and left, but actually just starts to look at what do these people need? What is going on here? How can we give them the best evidence-based treatments to help them help relieve their distress? And that's what we need to be looking at.
I mean, you understand why somebody like me would be so alarmed about the issue of informed consent. When you're talking about, when it comes to minors, when you're talking about somebody whose brain is not fully developed, certainly can't think long-term, doesn't even know what, you know, sexual function and climaxing is. You know, I mean, there's just a whole host of things they can't even possibly conceptualize, even if you described it to them. It would be, if they had perfect information, it would be hard enough because they can't conceptualize the things that you're talking about. And like you said, if they were on the table dying, you would override them and you would say, I'm not going to let you make this decision. I'm going to save your life. But when it comes to things like this that you say are elective, and they can't possibly conceptualize, and on top of all of that, the information they're getting may not actually be high quality information. And the doctor communicating it to them might not actually be doing it correctly, might not even be aware of the most recent up-to-date information. I don't understand how informed consent can be something we give to minors in this case, but you tell me your perspective on that.
Okay, so I mean, I'm going to give you the perspective of a neuropsychologist. So I talked earlier about the windows of development in puberty, and one of the key bits of the brain that is being wired up during that key critical period is decision making and how to make decisions. And there's been some fantastic work from one of my colleagues at UCL, Sarah Jane Blakemore, who's looked at how adolescents make decisions. And it's really interesting that they make them in a completely different way to children and adults. So they are in a different space because their brain is kind of under construction. And there are all sorts of features that adolescents will take into account that children don't and adults don't. So adolescents in particular, they really take notice of their peers much more than children. Children will take notice of adults. Adults will take notice of people who know. But adolescents really rely on their peer group because they are kind of creating their social kind of networks. So peers are much more important for adolescents. Adolescents are not very good at things in the future that they haven't experienced. So you said the ability to climax. If you haven't experienced that, they would find it very, very difficult to envisage what giving up that aspect of their life would mean because they haven't experienced it. The same with fertility. That, you know, if you ask a lot of young people, they'll say, oh, no, I don't ever want children. Well, by the time they get to...
I wanted zero, Sally.
I remember you saying that on another podcast. Yes,
I have five kids.
I know. I remember you saying that. So, you know, people, because you can't envisage what it's like to have a child until you have one. And think, oh, maybe I'll quite like another one. And keep going until you get to five, maybe. So there are all sorts of very specific things about the way that teenagers make decisions that are on top of everything you have just said about informed consent. So these are a really special group when it comes to can they make decisions about the future. And that's why we don't let, I mean, I don't know what it's like in the States, but certainly in the UK, we don't let them get tattoos. We don't let them get married, all sorts of big life decisions, because they're not in a neurological, neuropsychological state to be able to do those things. So it's really, really difficult. But I think what I would say is, in that, given all of that, the responsibility lies with the doctors. It's the doctors who are giving these treatments, and it is the doctors who must ensure that their patients understand what they are saying yes to. And it was quite concerning with the WPATH files that came out last week, that some of these doctors know that really what they are saying to the children who are supposedly consenting to some of these treatments, they really don't. They're not consenting. They really do not understand what they are saying yes to. And I think some of the doctors, well, that they were very open, that they appreciated that. So informed consent is really, really complicated, and even more complicated because you've got this rewiring going on in the brain during the time when you're making those big decisions.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to dismiss that concern when, like you said, the very people who are working for this worldwide advocacy group are parroting the same concerns as we are.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's not as if we are on one side, you know, two conservatives, you know, making some critique. I mean, we're all sharing the same concerns.
Yeah.
So at least it seems like many of the members of WPATH are.
Yeah.
Well, Sally, I have thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. You might have been one of the nicest people to deal with leading up to a podcast. I've just had such a pleasant experience on and off the air with you. But before we go, I do want to give you the opportunity to just, you know, make your pledge, you know, make your statement, talk about, you know, what do you think the state of the evidence is on puberty blockers, anything else you want to say, anything else you just kind of want to get out there before we wrap up today.
Okay. I mean, I think, well, first of all, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure to do this. I've never done a podcast before, and I've always kind of been a bit nervous of it. But having listened to you and sort of listened to your previous podcast, I did feel that this was a relatively safe space to come and speak. So it has been an absolute pleasure to do that. I think in terms of my my message. I don't really have a message. Like I say, I'm not an activist. I'm not a. I'm basically a researcher, and I'm somebody who is really committed to evidence-based practice. And I know from my kind of knowledge of the history of medicine that we don't always get things right, and we need to be constantly alert for when we're getting things wrong. Medicine can do amazing things for people. It can also really, really harm people. And we need to be vigilant all of the time to make sure that we are getting things right. And that just means being open. That means being open to looking at evidence, to constantly reassessing what we're doing, why we're doing it. And I think that would just be my kind of plea for people to just kind of look at evidence, be open to what you're doing, be open to changing, because I think most people have their patients' best wishes, best interests at heart. We can go off the rails, and we just need to be aware of that and kind of just always be, yeah, always kind of just checking what we're doing and why we're doing it, and open to listening. I think what scares me most about this area of medicine, which I haven't ever encountered before, is people saying the science is settled and there is no debate. There is no area of medicine where that is the case. And when you're dealing with young children who are very complex, who have all sorts of different needs, that certainly can never be the case, I think.
Well, that was very well said, Sally, and I appreciate that. Your insights are wonderful. I think you're a tremendous researcher, and you really give us a lot to chew on. So, and before you go, I just want to say, Fox and Friends, sorry, I mean, this was a really, you know, my podcast is extremely important. But Sally, really, it was a pleasure and a privilege, and your insights are really, really valuable. So thank you so much.
It's been an absolute joy. Thank you.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together? Just sing the song and bring the sunny weather. Happy trails to you till we meet again. Trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together? Just sing the song and bring the sunny weather. Happy trails to you. Again.
Goodbye, good luck, and may the good Lord take a liking to you.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.